welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Neurology. In this series of podcasts, a multidisciplinary team of specialists, plus a former care partner, share their perspectives on the impact and behavioural symptoms of agitation in Alzheimer's dementia, including discussion on diagnosis criteria and best practice management. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Lundbeck. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME in collaboration with the Gerontological Society of America, GSA. In this podcast, a geriatric psychiatrist, a cognitive neurologist, and a nurse practitioner discuss best practice management approaches for agitation in Alzheimer's dementia.
Hello and welcome. Today in this section, my colleagues and I will be discussing how the multidisciplinary team can help manage patients with Alzheimer's dementia with their agitated behaviors. I'm Dr. George Grossberg. I'm a geriatric psychiatrist at St. Louis University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, in the U.S. I have some wonderful guests with me today to discuss this important topic. I'm delighted to be joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Ali Atri, who is a cognitive neurologist at Banner Sun Health Research Institute, also in the U.S., and Ms. Susan Scanlon, who is a gerontologic nurse practitioner with a lot of experience in this area and a founder of Dementia Connection. So welcome to both of you. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, George.
So I'd like to kind of start things off by talking about how we can utilize the kind of the IPA framework for treatment planning in clinical practice. A couple of things that I've taken away from the IPA definition of agitation and the framework, and I think my guests know about this very well, is the importance of making sure that what we define as agitated behaviors are impactful, that they're really impacting quality of life for the patient and or the family, the care partners, or the professional care partners if they're in the hospital or the long-term care environment. The other take-home point for me is really the importance of persistence of symptoms. The symptoms should also be representing a change from previous behavior. And then very, very importantly, I think again, as my panelists know very well, to make sure that we're ruling out other potential triggers for agitated behavior, to not in a knee-jerk or automatically kind of assume that these behaviors are coming from Alzheimer's dementia, but to make sure we've ruled out other potential causes. Once we've looked at this agitated behavior and we determine it's part of the Alzheimer's disease spectrum, then of course the first guideline that we have, and again, the IPA, all the organizations stress this, is to think about non-pharmacologic and psychosocial care type approaches. And I wonder if maybe, Susan, you can kind of start us off by sharing with us some of the approaches that you've found to be helpful.
Absolutely, George. This is so important because, first of all, we have the issue that often families do not understand that we can do something about these behaviors as described in the IPA criteria. We have both research. There's a lot of good research now on non-pharmacologic interventions, as well as psychosocial interventions. So often families and also healthcare providers kind of throw up their hands and say, hey, this is an irreversible illness. It's going to get worse. There is nothing we can do. And unfortunately, a lot of care partners in the community get that message. But what we do know is the multidisciplinary team, whether it's in an outpatient clinic or inpatient long-term care, we can share that there is hope, you know, to manage this because it's a huge, huge impact. It affects everything the caregiver does. You know, very often they survive on very little sleep, stress, and depression themselves. Caregivers are often suffering from clinical depression and anxiety because of this. So what we want to do as the team is educate everyone on what's out there. As far as psychosocial things, we can empower families, number one, about communication, because that's one of the most frustrating things. Very often, their loved one will say something or act out one of these behaviors, and the care partner will personalize it. So first of all, we have to teach them how to deal with that, how to respond to that so they're not aggravating, how to sometimes agree with what they're saying as opposed to opposing it and getting them more agitated. So communication number one. Also the same for long-term care settings and assisted living. They have to know that this is not normal behavior. This isn't Harry's usual self. There is something we can do about this, and we need to empower our multidisciplinary team. Non-pharmacologic things, what works? There's been some great studies on music therapy to calm agitated behaviors. One of them looked specifically at interactive music, where there's a live music participating. You know, that's not realistic for all the time. Another option is music playlists based on that person's type of music. So that's another option. Massage, as far as hand massage, is very good with lemon balm and lavender. Reminiscence therapy. I used to use a lot of validation therapy, in which you engage the person where they're at, exploring the behavior they're describing. You know, what is it you're seeing? And, you know, tell me about, you know, when did this start happening? And then you're entering their world. So important. There's all kinds of, you know, you see things like computers and robots and a different type of interventions. But massage, pet therapy has shown up too. As far as responding to the agitation, we have to look at the environment. Make sure the person at home or the nursing home, assisted living, is in a calm environment. We want to avoid triggering them either with not optimal communication. Be sure they're comfortable as far as temperature and lighting and noise, you know, not overstimulated with television programs or the news, for example. We want to simplify their tasks, make it easy for them. And like I talked about, there's many different types of psychosocial interventions. So we want to do those first. Now, if the person is a danger to themselves or others, or a serious safety issue. I've had patients trying to escape for their home, for example. You're not going to try a non-pharmacologic intervention in a serious situation. And Allie will talk about that when, as far as medications that we can use when non-pharmacological interventions don't work.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Susan. You kind of introduced our next section, and I do want to ask Dr. Autry, Ali, to maybe discuss. So in scenarios where, as you mentioned, Susan, where we either don't have the luxury of time for the environmental or the non-pharmacologic approaches to work because it's an urgent situation, or where those approaches have failed and we have ongoing issues, the good news is we now have pharmacotherapeutic interventions that are looking promising. And I wonder, Ali, if you could maybe quickly kind of give us an overview of those.
Yeah, thanks, George. I completely agree with you and Susan that really the first approach, it needs to be a proactive approach of increasing knowledge for the family about communication, about issues that may come up, to understand, you know, what is in the control of the patient care partners and to kind of mitigate. And also to think about whether, you know, if this is a sudden change, could this be medical? Could this be because they're constipated, not sleeping, in pain? Could this be a UTI? Could this be actually new medicines that have been put on, or are they withdrawing from medicines or alcohol? Could this be a mood disorder? So, you know, to be proactive about those things, and then to recognize the signs, you know, whether it's excessive motor activity, whether it's verbal behavior that's becoming more aggressive, whether it's physical behaviors that are becoming more aggressive, hopefully not to get to the point where, you know, the pot boils over in many cases. So you mentioned what are our options. Well, in Europe, we know that risperidone does have a a short-term indication, really in situations where there is severe and refractory issues that are impacting patient safety. We know the data about that. There's for groups, explanatory trials have suggested that there's small to medium effect sizes for those. The issue is that there's the side effects that come along with those medications. In the U.S., there's a black box warning, and we actually have not had a new medication approved until recently, which is specifically approved for agitation and Alzheimer's dementia. And one of the major issues, I would say, is that there's this confounding of calmness with sedation. Many of the medicines that have been tried, over the years, and the bar is not low. The bar is high for drug approval. So the studies have shown for a group on average, the benefits have not outweighed the risks, including many of the antipsychotics, anti-epileptics. We have SSRIs, for example, that are used, benzodiazepines that are used, and a mixture of these things are used, but again, off-label. More recently, brexpiprazole was approved in the U.S., and this was based on a decade of research and a number of trials, finally pivotal trials, that indicated that titrating up to a few weeks up to a 2 milligram dose as being a potentially the therapeutic dose, with 3 milligrams being also possible. However, if you look at the response curves for the average patient, this is not a drug that people responded within hours to a day or two. This is something that to anticipate on top of best practices. And one of the things that the major side effects of the drugs that are used off-label include, as I mentioned, sedation, but things like extrapyramidal. So people become stiff. They end up becoming very sedated. They aspirate, they fall. So gait issues, cognitive suppression. And one of the things that did not really show up in the brexpiprazole trials was a substantial signal for sedation that for example, affected falls, for example, or kinds of suppression.
It looks like, I was going to say, Ali, so it looks like we now have a first FDA-approved drug for agitation and Alzheimer's dementia. And I think, as you very well know, we have a number of promising agents in the pipeline, nothing that's extremely close. I do notice that just in the past week, the announcement came out that deuterated dextromethorphan quinidine was a negative study, a large placebo-controlled trial looking at the same indication. So this is not an easy area to develop safe and effective compounds in, but I think we are making further progress. So we are running out of time, so I want to thank both of my panelists, Susan and Ali. Thank you all very much for a very stimulating discussion, and I look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, Ali.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Neurology at www.touchneurology.com. Don't forget there are 4 other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.